And this is the fourth talk in the series of four. Next week we'll have a discussion on this topic, but it never concludes the subject, but it's the end of this particular series on the subject. But I want to use that as a springing board to say that whatever subject you touch in your spiritual lives, certainly whatever direction you go in terms of Buddhist understanding, this has to be at its base. We have to walk on the floor of anatta for Buddhism to open up into its true dimension of wonder and mystery. If we walk on the floor of I, me, and mine, re-solidifying each step as each foot falls, then the practice will be one in which there will be quite a lot of psychological sophistication and sanity and health, but you'll never pierce the floorboards because the assumption of self never ends itself, never puts an end to itself. And so this series, although it's given as a series, really has to be the underlying foundation on which we stand in our spiritual practice. We have to keep questioning this. Now, it's interesting. I don't know if you've ever been to a great symphony or read a great Shakespearean play where you find yourself having to rise up to meet the work of art. You have to pull yourself up to the dimension from which the work comes. And I think anatta is of that same ilk, that same dimension. We have to rise up. We can't expect it to meet us where our assumptions lie. We have to rise up above our assumptions and really put some energy and effort to move our head above the surface of the water to understand what this topic is really about in its true fulfillment. And many of you have thanked me for this series, and I appreciate that. But it doesn't stop with this series. In fact, I was very reluctant to even offer this series in the beginning because I thought, is it just too abstract? Is there any way to make this realistic enough so that people can actually work in integrating that understanding in their life? And some of your comments and some of your explorations in the intervening weeks after the talk has shown me that there is, which has given me a great deal of confidence in being able to say that the deepest aspects of this tradition can be known, can be understood. We can begin the journey. Perhaps it's a journey that we're uncovering here. It's not a complete package of understanding that comes to us all in one rapturous moment, but rather it's a kind of a slow integration through our questioning, through our wonder, through our willingness to pursue this topic, that the topic begins to open up in its full flowering. And so the topic is, who am I? And the topic is assured. There's assurance that it'll shake us if we take it on with sincerity. It's got to shake us. Hopefully it doesn't stir us up too much. So you might say, shaken without stirred. It's a bad joke. And through our willingness to participate in these talks, through our understanding and through the homework and then through the dialogues, we begin to see the strategies by which the sense of I, me, and mine play forth. Because you might want to ask yourself, are we any closer to answering the question, who am I? No. Because it's not about answering it in sort of some kind of solidified form that I say, this is who I am, which would be just a further story, right? but rather to ask the question, to ask the question. To say, okay, who am I? I read this, someone gave me a nice Zen book. And this was written in the, said, relaxing after his Zazen, a student asked, what is the spirit of Zen? The Roshi said, inquiry. The student scratched his head and asked, what do I inquire about? And the Roshi said, good start. So the student is asking for a conclusion, is asking for schoolwork. And the Roshi is perpetuating the mystery. And the student keeps coming through the mystery to a conclusion. And the Roshi's job is to take the conclusion and throw it back into the mystery. So it's not about who am I equals an answer. It's about who am I as the question, who am I? As the wonder. And as we begin to have unraveled what it means to ask a question, it means that we are on very unsure ground. What the mind tries to do, just as you could, is again, when you understand the mind, we understand the sense of self and how it forms. The sense of self tries to move from uncertainty to certainty. The heart longs for uncertainty. So its constant movement is to move from the certainty of what the mind is constantly solidifying in front of itself to uncertainty. And therein you have all the paradoxes of spiritual work. And it's so interesting to be asked a question and to have that moment in which you just need to know the answer. There's that sense of, it's almost a struggle towards the answer. And we miss the beauty of the uncertainty because we try to get over the uncertainty. The uncertainty is the problem. And so it's, we just have to welcome a different dimension of ourselves here into being. That's why we have to rise up to the Dharma. We rise up to the Dharma. And in that rising up, you hold any great work of art, a Shakespearean play, or in a mystery, in its rapturous uncertainty. How else could it get into the heart except just through its utter eloquence? So just to get a sense now, of all the different displays of that uncertainty, not just asking a question, but those moments of creativity, those moments of spontaneity, those moments in which we are out of control, in which life isn't a sure bridge from our influence through our objective to our certainty. That moment of I don't know. That moment of I don't know. And you can feel the innocence of heart. I don't know. I don't know. And you can feel the quality of presence in the true sense of I don't know. I love this. Science has always seem to work parallel to my spiritual focus. And this particular article is called How Physics is Like a Grin Without a Cat. And it tries to, this article is about these quarks, which are considered to be the basic components of protons and neutrons. Anyway, so let me just read. These particles bring problems, however. Frequently, they don't actually exist discreetly in the real world. What we seek is what we get, and what we get only are statistical probability, not measurable certainty. We're told, for example, that the top quark was spotted as a remnant trace from two head-on proton collisions at close to the speed of light, and that this quark probably hadn't existed as a separate entity since immediately after the Big Bang several billion years ago. Over the last seven decades, Max Planck and Erwin Schrödinger's quantum mechanics have suggested that the most infinitesimal stuff in the universe consists of discrete quanta of energy, waves, and particles, each a form of the other, each turning into the other. Furthermore, whether we see such quanta as particles or as waves depends on what measurements we use. If our apparatus measure waves, we will observe them as waves, and vice versa. Additional constraints limit our knowledge. In basic human thought process, language sets the boundary, for we cannot progress beyond ideas for which we have words. With numbers, Kurt Gödel's famous 1931 theorem showed how mathematics cannot be used to define the most fundamental mathematical concepts, because trying to do so involves a circular logic that cannot be used as a tool to get inside itself. In the wonderland of subatomic particles, things get curiouser and curiouser. If history is any indicator, signs of still other wave/particles will, of course, be found. But since we and our instruments both have limited perception and form part of the very system we are trying to measure, we will never be able to plumb the lowest layer. In trying to fathom the vengeful urging of his father's ghost, Hamlet knew it too well. He said, "There are many things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt in our philosophies." So that's our problem. See, we have a mind, and the mind has created our world. And then we try to figure out what our world is created from using the very instruments of mind that created the world. And the cat chases its own tail. So we have to have another instrument. We have to glean a purified instrument, not the mental instrument. The mental instrument can never see an end to itself. How can it? So that instrument that we do have, but which is so identified and enmeshed with the mental instrument, which is the whole process of spiritual growth, is to decide which one is the pure instrument and which one is the contaminating mental influence on the pure instrument. The pure instrument is awareness. But the pure instrument keeps getting contaminated by the mental problem. And the mental problem keeps referencing itself. And the pure instrument, which is why it's pure, if we're quiet enough, can see the obscuring qualities of the mental problem. And so it can be one step removed from the problem itself, because it always has the ability to observe it. The Buddha said, and I've said this, but I want to say, he said, awareness is the Lord over everything. Meaning, awareness is the ground on which all factors of mind, all mental processes walk. And therefore, if we just allow awareness itself, it is the most refined instrument that we can bring to the problem, and the only one that we can actually trust. Because you can't trust your mind, that's the problem. So you can't trust the problem to solve itself. So we have to trust another component. Isn't that, I mean, it's just, so as we sit, We watch the breath, and then we grumble about how bored we are. Which instrument is the grumbling? You see? Okay, so that, okay. So we don't, what do we do with that? Do we get upset with it? Well, that's more mind. See, just, you can just look at it this way. So I'm bored. Oh, God, I'm always bored. I have to go back to bed. This is just, I can't sit with, all of this is happening on the ground of awareness. All of this has the potential to be seen, but mostly we're just identified with the script, just with the wording. And we fall into the identification of the wording, never recognizing that the ground is there all the time. It's showing us everything. We're just up here grumbling. Oh, sleepy again. Oh, my knee hurts. And five more minutes and I can't stand this. And on it goes. And we never allow ourselves to be quiet enough to bring forth the true purity of the instrument. We're much more interested in resolving the mind's problem through the mind, which is to go back to sleep, to rub the pain, to scratch the itch, to find the perfect relationship, perfect job, etc. And we work to resolve the problem. Now, okay, so what have we learned in these talks? One thing we're learning is the difference between the subjective and the objective. When we, awareness, can see something, then there must be a difference between awareness that sees it and the thing it sees. Right? Or, taken personally, if I'm able to see my emotions, if I'm able to hear my thought, I can't be thinking my thought and hearing them at the same time. It's impossible. And you can get a feeling for that in your meditation because the whole mind is on display. And awareness, since it is the ground through which all the mind comes, we can begin to see, oh, well, this can't possibly be me. These thoughts can't possibly be me. Because they're being heard. They're being heard. And my emotions are being felt. They are clouds moving by. They're not me enmeshed in some kind of problem. It's just a mental configuration which is the problem, and all of that can be seen. So that gives you a sense already, a growing sense, and it's a growing sense. It's a growing sense. That what the mind perceives, this I am not. I am not this. It's like the space and the forms in the space. The space holds the form, but the space isn't the form. And if you can see the form, then the space can't be it. And we also learned, or can learn in our meditation, another way that the I comes out, that the sense of self is created, and that is in our reactions. Sitting, and there is a physical sensation. It's like below the discernment level that it's even painful. But then it gets painful. And like a springboard, it doesn't just stop with being painful. It turns into, oh, this is the chronic problem I have with my knee. And if I keep sitting like this, inevitably, it's going to make me walk with a limp, ruining my future, never be able to play tennis again, on and on. And the point, though, is that the reactivity brought forth a story with it. And the infusion of me came within that story. It wasn't in the reaction. I mean, just sometime, feel the pain or the itch or the unpleasantness and let the story just be a couple of feet, float a couple of feet above it. So that you feel the sensation of unpleasantness and then you hear the story. And then you go back and you feel the sensation and then you hear the story. And you begin to get a sense that the story is the offspring of the unpleasant sensation. It's creating, the reaction is created from the story, not from the unpleasant sensation. The unpleasant sensation doesn't cause a reaction. It's the sense of me touching it and springing forth into thought, like a diving board. And that need to tell the story, once we're in a story, then we are locked in. We are just locked and loaded in this particular narrative about I, me, and mine. Past, future, fantasy, embellishment. Just the waves just go out forever. And we try to reason ourselves back using the very, or think ourselves out of the problem. I've got a problem. I think I can just, let me just work on it. Using the same instrument that the problem is to solve the problem. Just like this mathematical, indeed, let's see. Trying to do so involves a circular logic that cannot be used as a tool to get inside itself. Because the story just keeps tying itself to more story. The story doesn't end. And I can, once I have moved away from the pain into the story, and then I try to solve the pain through the story, I'm in insanity. That's the realm of insanity. And we do that, don't we? Trying to figure it out. And we want the story to move towards a happy ending. So we move it towards a happy ending in thought. But the happy ending isn't in reality. It's in Hawaii, where I used to be. I pick on Hawaii a lot in my talks. Because it's a deva realm. It's like, there's nothing wrong with it. So my mind will go to my vacation in Hawaii. It's much better to be in Seattle. There's something wrong with Seattle. And just as in the Buddhist cosmology, there are whole realms of devas, deva realms, God realms. And then there's a whole realm of hell realms. And then the realm that's right between the heavenly realms and the hell realms is the human realm. And the reason that the human realm is thought to be the best dimension, the best realm for freedom, is because it provides an equal quantity of pain and pleasure. If you're just in pleasure, who wants anything else but that? If you're just in hell, you can't see anything else but that. Anyway, I don't usually go in that direction, but just to give you a sense that Hawaii can be too much of a difference. And if I react to the pain, it's more story. And I can't think myself out of the problem because that's more story. And the story generates itself on and on. And it does so, it tries to solve its problems by sheer fantasy, by drifts of thought, which is more story, which really separates, it gives it psychic distance from the problem. It tries to solve the problem by giving psychic distance to the problem. Denial, rationalization, justification, blame, all of the defense mechanisms. Our psychic tension, psychic tension. Why do we call them psychic tension? Because they're not real. The further we get away from the problem, the more tension is going to be produced, obviously. Now, eventually, what happens is that I have to go into the problem. But I can't do it with thought, can I? I can't think about it because that's still creating some relief from it. I have to go into the problem in the reality of the problem, in the actual sensation of the problem. What is actually occurring in there? And so that's where the resolution of Buddhism takes us, as opposed to most other forms of healing, which are to rub it out or to fix it or to correct it somehow, rather than actually facing it, orienting ourselves to it. I mean, I wish it weren't so. Because I'd like to be a nice guy. Because when you bring in this level of solution, you aren't a nice guy anymore. Because nobody is hearing what they want to hear. But that's it. And so we have to go into the pain. Because it's in the juncture of the pain that the mind breaks itself open and fractures itself into pain and other. And that's where all narratives have its storyline. And that's where all sense of me has its beginning. So what do I bring? I like this. So what do I bring to the narrative, to the pain? What do I bring to all of that? I bring silence. The absence of narrative. I bring nobody to the somebody of the pain. The somebody of the pain is being created in the tension I have with the pain. So I bring awareness. I'm saying the same word over and over again. Silence, stillness, nobody, awareness. Awareness is the nobody, is the stillness, is the silence that allows non-resistance. Resistance is created by the explanation or justification of the narrative and aversion to the pain. But if I bring awareness to the pain, I'm bringing storylessness, the end of story. Do you see? Thereby, silence becomes the great healer. So one way pain keeps its outward focus is through the way we fixate ourselves within the story. So I want to talk about that for a minute. We freeze our place in the narrative. We rehearse the narrative. My story. Let me tell you my story. Let me tell how bad it was in my childhood. How awful I feel now because of that childhood and the inevitable problems that the future will hold because of the childhood that I have to live through. And all along, nothing has been fixed. Nothing has been fixed. There is no fixation, not in reality, but the sense of me, the storyteller, needs an embodiment, needs a sense of past and future to give itself a sense of fullness. So it falls back to the narrative to justify its actions and its misery in the present, and to actually encourage more misery. We have to justify the story of the past, which was a miserable one. To show how miserable it is, look how miserable I am now. And look how miserable I'll be tomorrow. And so almost unconsciously, we perpetuate the same storyline within the fixation of the story. It's so interesting, because none of it was ever fixed. Yes, yes, you had physical abuse. And I mean, some of our stories are horrendous. I have no doubt about that. But that's not the complete story. Here's what the Buddha said. Listen to some of these things he said. Some of these quotes go right to the heart. Non-identification with anything has been declared by the Buddha. For in whatever way one conceives, the fact is other than that. Majjhima Nikaya 113, for those who would like to look that up. For whatever way one conceives of the fact, of your story, of any fact, the truth is other than that. Because, look at it. If we just look at the truth of ourselves, it doesn't solidify into a fact. A fact, a story, is only one way. But reality is open-ended. It doesn't even solidify into a word. It's in constant movement. It's in constant flux and change. So it can't be one way. And to claim it to be one way is just a view upon it, not the thing itself. So let me read this. This is Richard Feynman, who was a Nobel physicist, I believe. Is no one inspired by our present picture of the universe? This value of science remains unsung by singers. You are reduced to hearing not a song or a poem, but an evening lecture about it. This is not yet the scientific age. Perhaps one of the reasons for this science is that you have to know how to read the music. For instance, the scientific article might say, the radioactive phosphorus content of the cerebellum of the rat decreases to one half in a period of 2 weeks. Now, what does that mean? It means that phosphorus, that is in your brain and in the rats, is not the same phosphorus as it was 2 weeks ago. It means the atoms that are in the brain are being replaced. The ones that were there before have gone away. So what is this mind of ours? What are those atoms within consciousness? Last week's potatoes. They now can remember what was going on in my mind a year ago, a mind which has long since been replaced. To note that a thing I call my individuality is only a pattern or dance, that it is what it means when one discovers how long it takes for the atoms of the brain to be replaced by other atoms. The atoms come into my brain, dance a dance, and then go out. There are always new atoms and always doing the same dance, remembering what the dance was yesterday. See, I love it when science and there's more and more, those two are beginning to meet. So what is he saying there? He's talking Buddhism. He's saying exactly what the Buddha said. Whatever way one conceives, it's other than that. It can't be held fixed in a fixed way. I looked up in the dictionary the definition of a person. A person is the embodiment of distinct traits of mind and behavior. Long-standing patterns or characteristics such as shyness, gregariousness, aggression, or passivity. A person is the unique constellations or qualities of all the changing patterns of the mind. That's the dictionary's word. So what are we doing? Why don't we just read the dictionary? Why do we keep coming out of that with the strong sense of I, me, and mine? That fixation reference of fixation. Because we do it, we have to treat it seriously. We do it. So what do we get out of it? It's always helpful to know what we get out of it. We get stability out of fixation. Even miserable fixation. We get stability out of it. If I can fix something, it's no longer a question. Do you see? Now we come all for a full circle. If I can fix something and know it, it no longer remains uncertain. And so the mind actively fixates, creating its identity through solidifying that which can never solidify. That which can never be called this or that, it calls this or that. Why can it never be called this or that? Because when any of us look at this or that, it's not this anymore. It's that. It's moved. It's moved on. It has to move on. Everything is moving on. It's only the mind that constantly tries to reference from a whole pattern an embodiment of distinct traits in mind and behavior, a whole plethora of mind states. It says, shh, I'm angry. Where was that? Yesterday at 2 o'clock? And what we mean when we say we've been healed from anger, no more anger. No more, that will never occur. Good luck. And who cares whether it does or not, if it's just a constellation, a kaleidoscope of a waterfall effect. But the fixation points out a reference point, the one that it feels most comfortably referencing, usually because of some past situation or parental invective that said you are an awful angry person or something. We keep referencing ourselves in relationship to one condition and a multitude of conditions. No matter what one conceives, the fact is other than that. See, as soon as I can reference something and say, it's my fault, then there's the emotions around it being my fault, which are shame and guilt. And then there's the comfort of having shame and guilt from the past and the knowledge of where I am as a shameful person. And then the whole embodiment of me comes through that narrative. And I can walk very comfortably to my neighbor's or to my clergy's house to ask for forgiveness and do confession. But we need to be stronger than that. For the self is not fixed. It never was fixed. Memory is just an aspect of the unfixed quality of it. Why keep referencing a certain aspect of the memory? We don't even reference the whole memory. Just the part in which has a particular disturbance to it. A certain charge to it. Oh, that's it. That's the one I remember. Very selective is our memory. And our fixation is equally as selective. No wonder the Buddha said that any statement of I am is insanity. In the Hindu tradition, there is the god Shiva, multi-armed god. And in the statue, Shiva is on the back of a human being, in this case a man, who is bent over studying a leaf, fascinated by the leaf. The meaning of the statue in the Hindu tradition is that we are so fixed upon the forms of fixation in the world, so focused on the expressions of life and the experience of life right in front of our eyes, that we miss the fact that God is on our back. So we just need to look up. For us to change the way we hold life, not in trying to form our sanity from the insane displays that are in front of it, not trying to get you to like me. That's an insane display. Not trying to rearrange the different forms that my mind has projected and created anyway into a meaningful system so that I can walk in there, but rather to let it all fall back in an unfixed quality into the question itself, into the mystery. And some of us are so caught in the problems that we live with, we can't even listen. It's like, you just don't understand. So many of us have to go through endless incarnations of somebodyness before we'll touch the pain and meet it with silence and stillness. And come to the nobody of the question, the nobody of the non-fixed world in which there is true freedom. And awareness may momentarily configure itself as a person, and then in a different moment it is no longer a person. And then it configures back and does something functional, and then it floats back. And that is a display, and the end of the stillness is a display. And it's just one display upon the ground of silence, another display. And we just sit and hold the display. We sit for a minute or two.